All right, we're underway then with session 59, lesson 11, page 16, on your outline. All righty, well, let's take a quick look at where we have been the last few weeks and then move into the new material. The Passover Lamb of God, Yeshua, God's perfect Passover Lamb, is come into Jerusalem on the 10th of Nisan. And the Passover lamb was examined from the 10th of Nisan to the 14th of Nisan to be sure that it was without spot or blemish. And so God's Passover lamb, Yeshua, also was examined between the 10th and 14th of Nisan. He was examined for blemishes in the temple. He was challenged in four different areas. One, he was challenged in regard to his authority. Who gave you the authority to teach? Secondly, he was challenged in regard to politics. Should we pay taxes to Caesar? Then he underwent two theological challenges. Is there a resurrection? And finally, a Pharisee wanted to know, I want to know what the bottom line is in your doctrinal statement. And Yeshua passed all these tests in flying colors. And then he asked the religious leaders some questions, which they could not give a satisfactory answer to. And then we finished up with him launching into the seven woes against the Pharisees. And those woes formed a circle. And you can start anywhere on this circle. You always end up back where you began. But Yeshua started with the fact that they had rejected his messiahship. They reject him as Messiah and the Messianic kingdom. And he said that leads to the fact that you are misleading others. And by the way, this handout, cycle of rejection has been given to you in your handout on your desk. You mislead others, and that's because you have improper priorities, which lead to an incorrect emphasis, an emphasis on external actions, and an emphasis on external appearances, rather than an emphasis on the internal. And that, of course, leads to a rejection of the prophets, and rejecting the prophets, of course, leads to rejecting the Messiah. So the nation was going around in this horrible cycle of unbelief. And we are still going around in this cycle of unbelief today, too, in Rabbinic Judaism. So that's where we finished up last week with the seven woes against the Pharisees. Now we move into section 201. In section 201 we come to the poor widow's gift of all that she had. So this is page 16 of the top of your outline, and it's page 194 in your harmony. Middle of page 194. We'll read the Mark account, which is the left-hand column. So everybody get there okay? All righty. Verses 41 through 44. And he sat down opposite the treasury and began observing how the multitude were putting money into the treasury. And many rich people were putting in large sums. And a poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which amount to a cent. And calling his disciples to him, he said to them, truly I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all the contributors to the treasury. For they all put in out of their surplus, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she owned, all she had to live on. Okay, so this is instruction in the treasury. This is his last day in the temple. Now, the treasury was the name given to 13 bronze chests called trumpets in which the offerings for the temple were dropped in by the temple worshipers. Now, we looked at this earlier in section 136. The treasury stood in the outer court of the women, the court of the women. So here's the Herodian Temple Mount, and we'll zero in on the temple itself. And the court of the women is the easternmost court here, the court to the front. So we'll bring that in close. Now here you can see the location of the treasury of these trumpets. So let's now go down to the floor of the court of the women and take a look. Here we are at the Court of the Women, looking at the Nicanor Gate, and the treasury are these trumpets off on the right and the left. So let's amble over to that area. So we'll get a little closer. Again, you can see here are the trumpets. And let's walk over a little closer, and there is a close-up of this artist's rendition of the trumpets. Now, we've never found any one of these things, so we don't know exactly what they look like. So this is one artist's rendition. Now, also in another Orthodox book that I have, an artist rendered the trumpets or the offering boxes in this manner. And this is a very different rendering. We see a man pouring his offering into the offering box through a window there, and then the boxes being inside the room. So that's a possibility as well. We really don't know exactly what these things look like, but I do think that this is probably the better rendition right here. So this is the treasury. And the pushka box, right? You pushka it into it, yes. So now, Yeshua observed this poor widow woman putting her gift into the treasury. And I like this illustration, although it's a little stereotypical. Jesus on the left there is, of course, very stereotypically drawn in pure white. But he is pointing out this poor widow woman to his disciples who are sitting around. And in the background, you see a rich man putting his offering into an offering box of some sort. I thought that was kind of a question. Well, you see the way the other disciples are dressed? He looked more like that. But Tissot, who's the French artist here, always draws Jesus in pure white. And many times you'll see the stereotypical rendering of him with a red sash across. That's just to identify him. You know, and others put the little halo around his head and that kind of thing. Well, that identifies him in the picture, but the scripture says he didn't look anything unusual. He didn't look unusual at all. You know, there was nothing about his appearance that made us think that he should be the king. Nothing. Okay, so I also like this rendering too, with this widow woman and her poor offering surrounded by these kind of plump, richly dressed fellows. And you can see in the bottom left corner, this one guy's got his money bag, you know.
She's so beautiful, but the rest of the gene pool looks pretty rancid.
So, the artist has really focused in on this widow woman. I think this is kind of a nice illustration. We don't know exactly what happened or what she looked like, but she stood out. She stood out because this incident portrays the truth of his woes, the seven woes. One of the key problems of the Pharisees was externalism rather than internalism. And this is an example. He sees the wealthy ones casting much into the treasury. But their offerings are simply a small portion of their wealth. And the widow casts in the legal minimum. Now, the coin she gave away was the smallest Jewish coin, the least valuable Jewish coin in circulation at that time. And here's a scan of a dime. I just put a dime on my scanner and my widow's mite there. So you can get an idea of this little tiny coin and how it stacks up against the modern dime. She gave 2 lepta. A lepton was worth 1/64 of a day's wage. So Jesus said she spent her entire living. She spent all she had to live on. The wealthy gave out of wealthy externalism, but she fulfilled the internal demands of the law. She gave out of a trusting, self-sacrificing, loving heart. So Jesus points out a graphic contrast between a heart full of faith, a heart that trusted and loved God, and a heart that had no depth of commitment. Now, I've experienced a poor widow like this at Hut of Our Messianic Ministries. And I experienced this 10 years ago when the ministry got started, 10, 11 years ago. Because I received a note in the newsletter. We always leave a section of the newsletter where people can write us notes because we like people to feed back to us. And I got this note many, many years ago, and I have framed it. I have framed it because I don't want to forget this note. And I want to read it to you. This lady we knew up in Portland. And she writes, "Dear Bob and Susan, Hadabar Messianic Ministries is a wonderful name for your Jewish outreach. And the John 1:1, biblical reference, along with verses 2 through 4, are enough to send electric shockwaves up the spine of any clear-thinking human. I pray that God will bless your inherent expertise in pointing out to Jews and Gentiles alike just who Jesus really was, is, and always will be. I always pray for you folks every day. All right, now I'm going to try to hold it together as I read the next sentence, okay? I don't always make it. I am sorry my gift is so small. My social security below poverty monthly income does not pay all my bills and feed me too. She sent a gift along with this. Please pray for me that God will increase my income so I can send you more. Now, can you, well, that's why I put this up on the wall. Her offering came out of an income that didn't even pay her bills, that she had trouble feeding herself, and yet she was willing to give Hadavar some funds and wants to give us more. You'll see this on the wall of my office, because that is a woman who loves the Lord. First. She, I don't know. I haven't had contact with her in a long time. So there are women like this widow in the church today. There are people out there just like this widow. And I think it's a privilege to get to know her and a privilege to get that note from her. That's a woman who loves the Lord with all her heart. Say again?
How could you ever catch the check?
All righty. That takes us to page 17. And we come to an application. And again, we don't want to make this class just simply an intellectual exercise. We want it to affect our lives. So the theme I chose for application is the importance of godly attitudes. And of course, the theme came out of the biblical material itself. So read along with me. In this lesson, we have seen the religious leaders attack Jesus and try to prove that he is not the Messiah. Jesus reveals the reason why they are doing this in his denunciation of them. The main problem lies in their ungodly attitudes. Number one, they were legalistic. Number two, they had inappropriate priorities, putting stress on the externals and minors rather than on the internals and majors. As a result of their attitudes, they were hypocrites and prideful. And finally, they put too much stress on man's traditions and rejected, for all practical purposes, God's revelation. They would be held responsible and suffer the consequence of their ungodly attitudes. In contrast, Jesus pointed out the widow who, in genuine love and heartfelt commitment to God, gave her all to him. God didn't want or need her money, but he did want her heart. Her gift of the legal minimum was the outward expression of a heart that belonged to God. She was no hypocrite. Her attitudes were pure and godly. So by personal application, now we need to ask ourselves the hard questions. We need to ask ourselves, what are my attitudes like? Would the Messiah be pleased with my attitudes? Am I a hypocrite? Are my attitudes godly? Are my attitudes legalistic, thinking that others cannot be as spiritual as me if they don't think or act like me? Are my priorities in balance? Am I being concerned about the things that really count in my relationship with God, or am I just filling my life up with trivia? Thirdly, is there pride and hypocrisy in my life rather than humility and honesty? Finally, am I taking God's revelation, the Bible, seriously, trying to put it into practice in my life, realizing that I will be held accountable to God, realizing that I am responsible to respond to his revelation, or am I simply waltzing through life indifferent to God's claim upon me and his authority over me, and yet still calling myself a believer? So you have a little bit of room under plan of action. You might want to jot something down there that if any of this strikes your heart, you might want to just jot something down to try to make this practical for yourself. I'm not going to ask anybody to share, but I'll give you half a second there to just maybe jot something down by way of application. All right. Let's move on to section 202 then, the setting of the discourse. We now come to the Olivet Discourse. This is page 195 in your harmony. Part 11, Prophecies in Preparation for the Death of the Messiah. So the Olivet Discourse, prophecies about the temple and the return of the Messiah. So section 202 deals with the setting of the discourse. Now, Yeshua made it clear that he would not return to Israel until Israel asked him to return. Section 200. The key to the second coming lies in Jewish hands. We have to ask him to return. Now, in this paragraph, he spells out the circumstances by which this will happen. Now, this paragraph is the end of his prophetic ministry, the end of his functioning in the role of a prophet. So these are the final prophecies that he will utter. Now, in the last section, we ended with Jesus in the treasury. And now he leaves the treasury. So we're at the historical setting. He's moving toward the Mount of Olives. So just to help us visualize that, I decided I would trace probably the most direct route to the Mount of Olives. So he's somewhere in the court of the women at this point, and over by the trumpets. So he leaves the court of the women, and he goes out the easternmost gate of the temple. And at that point, he went through the Soreg, and then probably took a left-hand turn and headed for the Golden Gate. So again, I'm just choosing this route because it's the most direct route to the Mount of Olives. I don't know exactly what his route is. So we'll back off a little bit and back off a little further. And there is what we call the Golden Gate today. Those two gates in the wall of Herod's platform there. So let's go in a little bit closer to that gate and see what archaeologists think it looked like. Looked something like that. Now, this is the same location today, but the gate we just looked at in the drawing is underground, well underground. These walls are, I think, a combination of Crusader and Muslim building. But this is what's called the Golden Gate today, and you see it's all blocked up, and there's an Arab graveyard in front of it. That's because I believe it's in Saladin's time, maybe a little later. Word got out that the Jews were expecting the Messiah to come through this gate to start up the Messianic kingdom. So the Arab fellow, the Muslim who was ruling Jerusalem, said, well, we can fix that. So he had those gates shut, and stones put in place, and then he had a graveyard put in front of the gate because no respectable Jewish Messiah would ever defile himself by walking through a graveyard. Question?
That's also called the East Gate, right?
Yes, it is the Eastern Gate, yeah. But by the way, you guys, this gate has nothing to do with the Second Coming, so not to worry. The temple where the Messiah will come through the Eastern Gate is the Millennial Temple talked about in Ezekiel. It is not Herod's Temple Mount. But there is the gate as it looks today from the outside. Now, let's go around to the inside. And remember, everything we looked at in the drawing is underground here. We know it's there because a student, an archaeology student, exploring that area years back, fell through the ground into a grave and was found himself up to his waist in human bones. And he saw the top of the arches, and he photographed the top of the arches coming up out of the ground. So we know there's a gateway underneath this one. We can get almost down to the first century level if we go inside the Temple Mount. Now here we are walking on the inside of that gate at ground level. But you see there's something below ground level there at the railing. So let's go over to the railing and peer down. And that is looking down close to the first century level. So the actual gate is somewhere down there. We haven't been able to excavate it because the Muslim authorities will not allow any kind of archaeological exploration to go on the Temple Mount. But someday it may occur. But the real gate is somewhere down there in that area. All right, so Yeshua has probably walked over to this gate, and then he leaves the Eastern Gate, the Golden Gate. And some feel that there was a bridge going across the Kidron Valley over to the Mount of Olives. That may be so. And this artist has included that bridge in the drawing. If that bridge did not exist, well, he could have easily walked down the slope across the valley and then up the Mount of Olives. So that could very well be the route that he took and he's now moving toward the Mount of Olives. So he's let's pick it up in Mark 13, verse 1, as he begins to move towards the Mount of Olives. And we'll pick it up, page 195. The Mark account is the middle column, chapter 13, verse 1. Everybody get there okay? All right. "And as he was going out of the temple, one of the disciples said to him, 'Teacher, behold what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings.'" So the disciples are admiring the Herodian temple, and it was something to admire, I will admit. Also, the Luke account, go across to the right-hand column, verse 5, the top verse in the Luke column. "And while they were talking about the temple, it was, and while some were talking about the temple, that it was adorned with beautiful stones, votive gifts, and he said." So yes, it was a beautiful bit of architecture, one of the wonders of the world. And I just want to give you a little bit of the overview of the history of the temple. The temple began with the Solomonic temple platform. This is the temple platform that Solomon built for his temple. It was 500 cubits square at the top of, over the top of Mount Moriah, and it it flattened the mountain out so that there would be a flat space for the temple to be constructed. So this is the original Solomonic temple and temple platform. And during the Greek era, in the intertestamental area, the Hasmoneans, or the time of the Maccabees. There he goes. Yes, the time of the Maccabees, the Hasmoneans, they freed Israel from the Greeks for 100 years, and they added an extension to the Solomonic temple platform, and they added some porticos around the edge, as you can see, and then that required some tunnels on the southern side, some tunnels to go up on the Temple Mount itself, and they also did this bridge on the western side of the temple platform. So the platform was extended slightly by the Hasmoneans. Then, as we come to the late first century BC and early first century AD, Herod comes along, and he extends the temple mount even to a larger extent. He could not extend to the east and the west due to the Tyropian Valley on the west and the Kidron Valley on the east. But he could extend the Temple Mount north and south, and you can see that he did. And this is the Temple Mount that we see today. So he did a lot of work. After the temple was destroyed in AD 70, the Muslims built the Dome of the Rock up on the Temple Mount in the same location as the Solomonic Temple, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the southern end of the Temple Mount. And you can see the Temple Mount today. You can see the Dome of the Rock, sitting where the temple used to sit, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, that's the gray dome on the left side of the picture, the southern part of the Temple Mount there. Now here's a view of the Temple Mount from the Western Hill. The Western Hill is called Mount Zion today. That is an incorrect label. Mount Zion is underneath the temple platform itself. It's biblically, this is the Western Hill. And here is a cutaway of the walls that were built to flatten out the top of Mount Moriah and to support the platform. You can see the mountain coming up from the southern end, the right side. It disappears under the Herodian wall, and it's colored gray. And then you come to that dark brown area. That's the peak of the mountain, the very highest spot. That's where the temple was located. And this is the Solomonic temple platform, 500 cubits square. And then this is the Herodian temple platform that Herod built. So you can see, let me back up a little bit here. You can see there's a lot of space under there. There's cisterns, all kinds of interesting nooks and crannies under the Temple Mount. Again, we cannot excavate or get under there because the Muslim authorities will not allow it. But it'd be nice if some archaeologists could have free rein to all that. All right, so the Temple Mount that Jesus experienced was started by Herod the Great in 20 BC. And it wasn't finished until A.D. 64. What happened in A.D. 70? The Romans destroyed it all. Okay, the only thing left is the platform now. So it only lasted about 6 years, the temple itself. In all its glory, only lasted about 6 years. Now the disciples are pointing out the massive stones that made up the temple. And those stones are very impressive. The Herodian stones are called ashlars. They all weigh several tons each. This is one that was found up in Galilee. Often stones from destroyed buildings are reused in other buildings. And you can tell this is an Herodian ashlar because of the border. See that distinctive border around the stone? This one is up in Sepphoris, by the way, up in the Galilee. But it's a good picture of a Herodian-type stone. Now here at the Temple Mount, the western wall, you can see a number of the ashlars fitting together to make up the platform, the wall of the platform, and you can see where Jewish worshipers have put prayers written on paper in the cracks there. But you can see the borders. That's the main thing I want you to notice here, the borders that identify the Herodian ashlars. Now, the longest and the largest of these stones ever discovered is 46 feet long, 10 feet high, and 10 feet wide, and weighs 415 tons. And if you take the rabbi's tunnel, you can see this stone. And you can go down to that level, and it's the big, flat stone kind of in the middle of the picture. Now, the Romans, of course, destroyed most of these stones, but when they came to this one, they couldn't do anything with it. It's 46 feet long, 10 feet high, and 10 feet wide. So what did they try to do? They tried to chip it away. So you can here's the top of the stone, and then you can see where the Romans tried to chip it away, and they finally gave up. They said it's just going to take too much time to erect this thing, so they just left it in place and built the smaller stones on top of it. Now the holes you see carved into the wall there are for tongues to be stuck into the wall for future building so they could adhere to the wall. Now here I am standing beside that huge stone, and you can see the Herodian border there very clearly, and you can also see that the top stone is set back about an inch, half inch or an inch from the stone below it. And that's the way the entire wall is made. Each layer of ashlars is set back just about a half an inch. Up, set back, so the whole wall actually is at a slight angle to the inside. Of course, that's to make sure that it doesn't collapse. So this is tremendous engineering. And all these stones are put in place without any mortar. It's simply stone to stone. And there's a lot of theories as to how they managed to do that in the first century, especially a 415-ton stone. How did they move it? How did they position it? But it's all done perfectly accurately, and it still stands today. Amazing. Now here I'm looking at the other way down that 46-foot stone, and you can see clearly the notches that have been added later on. Now into those notches a tongue, a protrusion was inserted, and then that protrusion would provide a footing for the wall that was going up right beside the new wall. Here you can see some of those tongues sticking out. And here at the bottom, you can see the new construction, how it was put into that tongue to have support against the Herodian wall. But that the construction at the bottom right-hand corner of the picture is new, relatively new, sometime after the first century. So it's quite an amazing... these stones are really quite amazing. I can understand why the disciples were amazed at them. All right, so at this time in its history, the temple was about halfway through completion. It was still under construction. But Jesus, as he walks through, says, "There shall not be one stone left upon another." Mark 13, verse 2. Mark 13, verse 2. And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left upon another which will not be torn down." And in AD 70, this was literally fulfilled. A torch was thrown into the temple by a soldier from the Roman army under Titus. It caught fire, and the temple and all the buildings were destroyed. And the heat of the fire caused all the massive amounts of gold in the temple to melt down and run between the stones. So the Romans wanted that gold, right? So what did they do? They levered up the stones. They pried them all up to get at the gold that was between them. And so all the buildings were demolished, and all that's left today is the remnants of Herod's platform. Now here is an artist's illustration of the temple going up in flames. You can see the Roman soldiers carting off the menorah, the temple of the table of showbread, the incense altar, all gold out of the temple to be taken back to Rome as spoils of war. Here's an illustration illustrating the fact that the Romans got up on the Herodian altar and slaughtered the priests as they were making some offerings there. So it was a pretty sad and gory scene on the temple when the temple finally fell to the Romans. Now, in this illustration, we're going to be looking at this area here. We'll be looking at the pier for the archway and the road, the Herodian platform, the Herodian road down here, and the shops that were on each side of that area. That's all been excavated now. Here is that first century Herodian pavement. That square building on the left is the pier that supported one end of the archway. And the temple, when it caught on fire, burned very, very hot. And limestone is a porous rock. It has moisture in it. And so the water in the limestone got hotter and hotter and hotter. And of course, when water gets hard, it produces steam and pressure. And eventually, these limestone blocks began to explode. And Josephus records the tremendous explosions as you heard these rocks exploding, and the rocks would explode out over this Herodian walkway and crash down to the pavement below, and you can see the damage that they caused. So it was quite an incredible time as the temple went up in flames. So here's another view of that Herodian walkway. The archaeologists have cleared away the fore section. So you can see the Herodian pavement and the damage that was done. But if you walk down to the other end, you can stand beside these huge chunks of limestone that were blown out of the temple wall by the heat of that steam. How'd you like to have those things fall on you? And again, I'm up now at the far end, at the up on the platform, and you can see down the Herodian street. You can bet your retirement that Jesus walked on this street. He probably walked on it dozens of times. And as you can see, they're quite large chunks of limestone. Quite an amazing sight there to walk along that street and see what happened in 70 AD. Now, go to page 19, top of the page. The Messiah's comments prompt three questions from the disciples. And so the three questions are listed there. Number one, what shall be the sign that the temple is about to be destroyed? This is the Mark account, verses 3 and 4. So the middle column, verse 3 and 4. And he was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple. Peter and James and John and Andrew were questioning him privately. Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things are going to be fulfilled? All right, that's the first question. Question number two is in the Matthew account, verse 3. What is the sign that the second coming is about to take place? So move to the left-hand column, verse 3. And as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming? So that's the next question. And thirdly, what is the sign that tells us that the end of the age has begun? And that's the rest of the verse. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So notice that all three questions include requests for a sign. Now Matthew will answer the second and third question, but he ignores the first. Luke will answer question number one. And Jesus will not answer the questions in the order that they were asked. So with that, let's go ahead and take your break. I've kept you 5 minutes over, so I'll give you a couple of minutes, almost 15 minutes for your break, but listen for the shofar and come on back when you hear the shofar. All right, let's pick it up then at section 203. We're on page 19, lesson 11, page 19, and we're in the middle of the page, the beginning of the birth pangs. The beginning of the birth pangs. So Yeshua now is on the Mount of Olives. He's made it across the Kidron Valley. Here's that illustration I showed you just a few minutes ago with the temple in the foreground. We're on the western hill, and there to the east of the temple is the Mount of Olives in this drawing. And here's the way the Mount of Olives looks today. There's a lot of buildings on the mount right now. Here we're looking across from the Temple Mount, across the Kidron Valley, the Church of All Nations in the foreground. You can see the Russian Church with its golden domes on the right side, and then, of course, the Mount of Olives in the background. Again, now this, I believe, I photographed from Caiaphas's, the location of Caiaphas's mansion. You can see the corner of the temple in the left-hand side jutting out of the picture, and then the Mount of Olives in the background. Now we're walking down Mount Zion, and the again you can see a corner of the temple jutting out to the left, Kidron Valley, portion of the Kidron Valley in the center, and then the Mount of Olives behind. Now this shot of the Mount of Olives shows a large Jewish graveyard. There's a huge Jewish graveyard located on the sides of the Mount of Olives. And if you go into that graveyard, this is what you'll see. These Jewish people are all buried there because they believe the scripture that says the Messiah's feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. And they want to be resurrected when he comes back. So they want to be buried there on the Mount of Olives, close to where the Messiah will be. That's the reason for the size of this graveyard. So Jesus is on the Mount of Olives, and in this illustration you can see the temple and Jerusalem in the background, the Kidron Valley in the background, and they're sitting on the side of the hill, and he's beginning to teach them about the birth pangs. So he's going to begin by answering question number 3 first. And he's going to start by describing general characteristics of the church age. Two general characteristics. Oh, by the way, it was pointed out to me that there's a typo on page 18. If you look on section 202, the setting of the discourse, it says Matthew 24, 1 through 3, and Mark 3, 1 through 14. That should be Mark 13, 1 through 14. So add a 1 in front of that 3 on page 118. Everybody see that? That's not my mistake. That's the computer's mistake. So I'm still okay. It was a bug in the computer, so I'm safe still. Still safe. All right.
Autocorrect.
Autocorrect, yeah, exactly. All right, Matthew. We'll pick up the Matthew account. Section 203, the Matthew account is the left-hand column. Matthew 24, verses 4 and 5. So we begin the general characteristics of the church age, the age we're living in now. And Jesus answered and said to them, "See to it that no one misleads you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Messiah,' and will mislead many." So one characteristic of the age we live in is the fact that there will be a rise of false messiahs. Now Jesus was the first to actually claim to be the Messiah, but many, many, many have followed. And if you're interested in this topic at all, there's a book out called The Jewish Messiahs, by Harris Lenowitz, by Oxford University Press. The Jewish Messiahs, from Galilee to Crown Heights. And he categorizes or lists 23 messianic claimants in the history of Israel. And the latest messianic claimant is Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson of Chabad, who died in 1994. I remember that very clearly because I was in Israel on Ariel Ministries' five-week study tour when he died. And here's a picture of him, and you can get this off the website. Based on many sacred prophetic Jewish sources, which have been actualized in recent history, the claims of these rabbis are accurate and credible regarding Rabbi Schneerson being Judaism's King Messiah. So that's a big mistake. It's too bad. I'm sure he was a wonderful man, but He's not the Messiah. And this is a poster you would often see, Yachi HaMelech HaMashiach. Basically, the idea here is, long live King Messiah. Long live King Messiah. Something like life to the King, the Messiah. And, of course, there's Rabbi Schneerson's picture. So he's the latest messianic pretender. Yes?
Did he proclaim that himself?
No, he never proclaimed that himself. His followers. Yeah. He only hinted at it. But his...
He knew that was what it said.
Yeah, he knew what that stuff said. He knew what they were saying. But he never actually called himself the Messiah. His followers did. Yes?
There was one that you talked about before that said he was Messiah, and then the other guys killed him?
The Jewish community hates this idea that he's considered the Messiah. They consider it, the most Jewish, most Orthodox Jews consider it a heresy that they would call him the Messiah.
But there was specifically another rabbi that you talked about.
Oh, yeah, there's...
Since he was supposed to discern things, like,
Yeah, there have.
So
yeah, that was Bar Kokhba.
Okay.
Bar Kokhba. He, Rabbi Akiva, claimed him to be the Messiah, and he was killed by the Romans. Yes.
Do his followers think he's going to be raised from the dead?
They did. They expected him to be raised in 40 days, and of course, he wasn't. So. Yeah, literal days. And so they visit his grave and they put all kinds of notes and prayer notes on his grave and all that.
But the posters are still all over Jerusalem.
Well, yeah, they...
So they're hopeful?
They're hopeful that he'll come back, yeah. They have all kinds of theories about it, yeah.
What year did he die?
1994, yeah. All right, so the rise of false messiahs does not indicate that the end of the age has begun. It's just a general characteristic of the church age that we are living in right now. All right, let's look at Matthew 24, verse 6. Verse 6, page 196, Matthew 24, 6. And you will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not frightened, for these things must take place, but that is not yet the end. So another general characteristic of the church age is wars and rumors of wars. And I think we can attest to the fact that has been true. There have been numerous wars all over the planet for the last 2,000 years. Now, come to page 20. Turn to page 20. And we come to the sign of the end of the age. Verses 7 and 8. Verses 7 and 8. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. But all these are merely the beginning of the birth pangs. So nation will rise up against nation. And this is the beginning of the birth pangs. So when we see nations rising against nations, we should realize that the current age, the church age, is coming to a close. And it's a common theme in the prophets that the end of the age is like a series of labor pains a woman goes through when she's giving birth. You know, the pains get more severe and more frequent as the birth of the child comes closer and closer. And so the last days of this age will be like a series of labor pains that give birth to a new age. So what will be the first birth pang that signals the end of the current age? That will occur when nation rises against nation and kingdom against kingdom. Now, this is different from wars and rumors of wars. This idiom, nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom, is a Jewish idiom for world war. A world war marks the beginning of the end of the church age. A local war, a rumor, is simply a general characteristic. And so we still see local wars and we still hear rumors of wars because that's just part of the church age. But a world war signals the beginning of the end of the age. And I've given you two rabbinic quotes in the middle of page 20. And here they are. I picked these up from Dr. Fruchtenbaum in Footsteps of the Messiah. He's quoting the Zohar Chadash, which is a mystical Jewish work. At that time, wars will be stirred up in the world. Nation shall be against nation and city against city. much distress will be renewed against the enemies of the Israelites. So the rabbis see this statement of nation against nation as referring to a world war. Also in the Midrash Rabbah, Genesis, 42:4, I think that is. If you see kingdoms rising against each other in turn, then give heed. Note the footsteps of the Messiah. So when you see a world war, pay heed because you'll be able to hear the Messiah off in the distance. He's coming. He's close enough that you can hear his footsteps. So World War I, I think, marks the beginning of the end of the age. The end of the church age began in World War I. And you know, World War I and World War II had a big impact on the Jewish community. For example, World War I lasted from 1914 to 1918. And that's when the Zionist movement gained hold. And it was in 1917, just before the end of World War I, that the Balfour Declaration was issued, for example. Here is a photograph of the letter that Lord Arthur James Balfour authored and sent to Lord Rothschild. This is the content of that letter. Foreign Office, November 2nd, 1917. So this is just before the end of World War I. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations which have been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours sincerely, Arthur James Balfour. So World War I brought the Balfour Declaration. The end of World War I brought the British Mandate and the hope for a Jewish national home. The British Mandate, the British were supposed to facilitate nation building for Arabs and for the Jewish community. Now, in 1920, 2 years after World War I, the San Remo Conference met, and this was the area allocated for a Jewish national home at the San Remo Conference in 1920. And you can see it's the light-colored area. And it's a little bit bigger than the territory we have right now, right? Yeah. Palestine was both sides of the Jordan River. That was Palestine. That was the British Mandate. Give this section, this territory, to the Jewish people for their national home. Well, what in the world happened? Well, Britain decided to divide the mandated area in 1921 through 1923. Why did they do this? Well, because Faisal of the Hashemite tribe was kicked out of Saudi Arabia by the Saudis. Okay, he was promised because his tribes aided the British in defeating the Germans and their allies in World War I. He was promised a homeland. So, because they had helped the British, Churchill and his cabinet decided to divide Palestine in half and call it Palestine and Transjordan and give Transjordan to Hussein, to the Hashemites. And so this eventually became the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, as it's known today. The Hashemite tribe rules that area. Even though they're a minority, the majority of the people living in that area are Palestinians. So that's how the division occurred in 1921 to 1923. So now Palestine was the territory to the west of the Jordan River. So the Jewish national home has now shrunk by about 70%. So that's what happened right around World War I. All right, the Jewish state was established in World War II. Let's see, I've given you some maps on page 21 there. Of your of your outline. And let's go through a little bit of the history to bring us up to date where we are today. The Arab peoples, the Muslims, of course, rejected any kind of a Jewish home on the western side of the Jordan River. And they fought over the whole idea. And finally, the UN in 1947 came up with their General Assembly Resolution 181, which said, all right, we're going to divide the territory to the west of the Jordan River between the Arabs and the Jews. And so this was their suggestion as to how the two countries should exist. Palestine would be the gray area, Israel would be the light area, and Jerusalem would be an international zone. Now that is about the most stupidest way to ever divide up a country, right? One person described the General Assembly resolution as two snakes entwined in a dance of death, you know? Anyway, that was the UN General Assembly resolution, 181. Okay, the Zionists said, okay, we'll take it. That's only about 10% of the area originally mandated for us, but we'll take what we can get. The Arabs said, nothing doing. We don't want any kind of a Jewish state there, and they attacked. When the war was over in 1948, the Jewish people, instead of losing the war, had captured most of the territory, and Egypt ruled the Gaza Strip. You can see that little strip in brown, and Jordan controlled Samaria and Judea, that light brown area, and Jordan actually annexed Samaria and Judea, and that became the country of Jordan, the West Bank of the country of Jordan. And that's the way it stayed until 1967. During all those years, 20 years, there was never any attempt to create a Palestinian state, nor even was there a mention of a Palestinian state. It had never entered anybody's mind until toward the end of that period when the Arabs decided to create a Palestinian state as a way to attack the Jewish people. So in 1967, we had the Six-Day War. And Israel conquered the Sinai Peninsula, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights. Eventually, the Sinai Peninsula was returned to Egypt in return for a peace treaty that's still in existence today. We don't know how much longer it'll last. But the West Bank, Jordan then abandoned the West Bank, and the Israelis occupied it, and we conquered the Golan Heights from Syria, which we still occupy today. So this is modern Israel today. Israel pulled out of the Gaza Strip a number of years ago, and that's considered the Palestinian Authority, and the West Bank still is being contested, and although portions of the West Bank are now considered the Palestinian Authority, and there's movement toward creating a, quote, Palestinian state. The Golan Heights, of course, still belongs to Israel. Israel and Syria are still in a state of war, technically. So Israel is occupying the Golan Heights. So that's what we have today. Question?
Eilat was always
Israeli. Okay? It's always been part of the area called Israel or considered Israel. Aqaba is the Arab town right next door to Eilat. That's in Jordan, okay, and the boundary runs right between the two of them. Quay again?
The Gulf of Aqaba.
The Gulf of Aqaba. Well, not necessarily. It's pretty much international because Jordan's one side of it, Israel is the tip of it, and Egypt is the other side of it. Okay, so it's pretty much international territory. All right, so that's Israel today. So World War I and World War II had a great impact on the Jewish state and the Jewish community. So now we come to the personal experiences of the apostles on page 21. By the way, if you're interested in more details on the modern state, in two classes, I'll be doing the Bible study methods next class, and then we'll do an extensive class on the history of Zionism and the modern state of Israel. So we'll go into that in greater detail. All right, so the personal experiences of the apostles on page 21, the middle of page 21, there'll be 8 points. So the first 5 points are on page 21. And the disciples, first of all, Jesus promises, will be rejected by the Jewish community. Let's pick it up on the Luke account, Luke chapter 21, verse 12. That's the right-hand column, page 196. So drop down to verse 12. Okay, everybody get there? But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and will persecute you, delivering you to the synagogues and prisons. All right, so before these things, that means before the events he's just talked about, the disciples and believers in general are going to be rejected by the Jewish community. But he also promises that they'll be rejected by the Gentiles. Second part of the verse. Bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake. And Paul was not part of the original apostolic band, but he was an apostle. And he gives us a little insight into what all the apostles and disciples experienced in the book of Acts, because he was persecuted by the Gentiles as well. Acts 13:50, but the Jews incited the devout women of prominence and the leading men of the city and instigated a persecution against Paul and Barnabas and drove them out of their district. Also another example, Acts 14:5-6. And when an attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers to mistreat and to stone them, they became aware of it and fled to the cities of Lycaonia, Lystra, and Derbe, and the surrounding region. So all the apostles went through that kind of experience, rejected by Jews and Gentiles. But in verse 13, Jesus says this persecution will provide an opportunity for testimony. Verse 13, it will lead to an opportunity for your testimony. And persecution usually does that, gives us an opportunity to witness, just like in Iran today with that Iranian-American pastor that's been arrested. Remember, we read about the great witness he's having. All right, fourthly, we're now the Luke account, verses 14 and 15. So make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourselves, for I will give you utterance and wisdom which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute. So God will give them the words to say when they're brought to judgment, and these words will be powerful words. Was it Agrippa that said to Paul, "You almost persuade me to become a Christian"? Powerful words, and yet he still rejected them. The Mark account. Go to the Mark account. That's on page 197. Verse 12. So go over to the center column on page 197 and look at verse 12, Mark 13:12. And brother will deliver brother to death, and a father his child, and children will raise up against parents and have them put to death. So he says this rejection is even going to include your families. So Yeshua knew exactly what was going on. He did not promise us a rose garden, you guys. Our troubles are not over in this world just because we trust in Yeshua. In fact, they tend to begin. They tend to begin, all right? So page 22 now, point 6, verse 13 of the Mark account. All right, page 22, top of the page, verse 13 of the Mark account. And you will be hated by all on account of my name. But the one who endures to the end, he shall be saved. All right, so the Mark 13 account says that they will be hated by all people. Now let's look at the Luke account, the right-hand column. Luke 21, let's read verses 16 through 18. That's the right-hand column. But you will be delivered up even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. And you will be hated by all on account of my name, yet not a hair of your head will perish. Now, this last phrase, verse 18, has raised a lot of controversy. Some think it refers to spiritual salvation. Some think the statement refers to physical salvation. I think spiritual salvation is preferable, especially in view of verse 16. Verse 16 says that some will die. Now, not all the apostles survived physically. Most were martyred. James, Acts chapter 2, verse 12 is an example. And as far as I understand it, John was the only apostle to die a natural death. However, all the apostles were eternally secure, no matter what persecution they encountered. Their souls were safe, and they were eternally secure. So in verse 18, nevertheless, their salvation is assured, their spiritual salvation. And then we read verse 19. By your endurance, you gain your lives, or gain your souls. So another somewhat unclear statement. Some think it refers to spiritual survival. Others think it refers to physical survival. And others think it refers to evangelism. I tend toward the view that he's speaking in reference to evangelism here. In spite of all that they will endure, they will see fruit from their labors. They will win their souls. I think that's the idea there. You can disagree with me, no problem. But I fall on that position there. Now at this point, I have to disagree with the harmony that we're using. Thomas and Gundry put Luke 21, verses 20 through 24 in the next section. But I think Luke 21, verses 20 through 24 belongs right here. Although we don't have time to cover that, we'll be starting next week on page 23 of your outline, and we'll look at the sign of the fall of Jerusalem. We've looked at basically the general characteristics of the church age, the sign of the end of the age, and now he'll answer the question, the sign of the fall of Jerusalem. So come back next week for that bit of information. All righty. So let me go ahead and pray, and we'll get you out of here on time. Father, again, we want to just pause and thank you for your word. Thank you for the fact, Lord, that you didn't sugarcoat anything, that you laid out very clearly what the church age is going to be like. That we as believers are going to go through struggles. It's going to be a time, a very difficult time, with wars and rumors of wars, and we'll see other characteristics of it as we continue. But you were totally honest with us. So help us to be totally honest with those whom we speak with about Yeshua, that this age is a troubled age, even though it is the church age. And then, Lord, we lift up that wonderful widow woman at the beginning of our class, a woman of great love for you, of great faith in you, a woman so in love with you that she wanted to donate her very livelihood for the functioning of the temple, for your work. So, Lord, help us to be like that woman, to be people of faith, to be people of hope, to be people that look beyond the current situation we're in to the messianic kingdom and to the eternal state. Help us to always be concerned with the salvation of souls, to keep our priorities where they should be, on your kingdom work and on our internal character. Help us to be like that woman. So, Lord, we lift this prayer up to you. We need your help to be people like that. And so we ask your Spirit to empower us from the inside out. And we ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, we'll see you next week.